convene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We have our third and last case for today, 01-3128, Conley Publishing Group Limited versus Journal Communications, Inc. and Journal Sentinel. Representing Conley Publishing Company, Stephen J. Berryman of Qualls and Brady. Counsel, you have 25 minutes. And 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Steve Berryman. I, along with my colleague Brian Winters, represent Conley Publishing Group, the plaintiff appellant in this matter. We come before the Court today to request that the trial court's grant of summary judgment to the journal be reversed and that the case be remanded for a jury trial in Waukesha County Court. The reasons that we believe that is the appropriate result are set forth in our briefs, but today I will address three main points in support of our position. First, the trial court totally ignored Wisconsin law on expert testimony, causation, and damages in this business tort case. The court applied new requirements that have never before been seen in the state of Wisconsin. In doing so, the court usurped the role of the jury. Second, if this court allows the trial court's judgment to stand and in effect adopts the dicta contained in the Brook Group U.S. Supreme Court decision, the result will be to extinguish the cause of action of predatory pricing in Wisconsin. And third, we will outline what we believe the court should do in this case and suggest a reasonable middle-of-the-road approach to dealing with predatory pricing claims under Chapter 133. Without getting into any significant detail of the facts, I just want to briefly outline the Sunday Daily Conversion Program that we complain about and state what Conley's claim was at the trial court.
Mr. Berryman, before you do that, you were indicating that we should not adopt the Brook Group Limited case in that approach. And yet, hasn't it been traditional in Wisconsin that we have followed the federal case law in regard to antitrust matters?
Judge, in fact, it has been traditional to follow federal substantive case law in antitrust matters. The distinction that we make is applying federal concepts of the evaluation of expert testimony, such as the Daubert rule, applying federal concepts such as causation, and also disaggregation of damages, which is a purely federal concept that we've never seen before in Wisconsin. The trial court in this case did each of those things, and we believe that at least for those procedural type issues, Wisconsin law should apply.
Counsel, to follow up Justice Cook's though, I mean, Brook has two elements. Brook defines predatory pricing. And then it sets forth two elements, and then it sets forth a bit of information, how to demonstrate the recoupment. That's the Brook test, as I understand it. Are you objecting to this court adopting that test?
Not exactly.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. It sounds to me, in response to your question, I didn't really hear a direct response. It sounds to me like you were saying, it's okay, Justice Crooks, we'll go along with adopting those two elements of Brooks and even how you define, demonstrate the recoupment. But what we are objecting to, after you set forth those elements in Brooks, is the application of Daubert and the application of the concept of disaggregation of damages. Is that your position?
That is not my position, Justice.
That is or is not?
Is not.
Okay. So tell me, what is your position with regard to Brooks?
Sure. My position is two things. First of all, what I just said. We shouldn't apply federal concepts of causation damages and the evaluation of expert testimony. But also, we should not apply the second portion of the recoupment requirement in Brook Group. And that's the portion of the recoupment requirement that all of the commentators agree has essentially destroyed predatory pricing as a cause of action. And in fact, the journal agrees, and we agree, that since 1993, when Brook Group was decided, there has not been a single predatory pricing case in the federal courts that has survived summary judgment. So our proposal, and I was going to get towards the end, but if I'd be happy to argue it right now, is that we do adopt a position that's consistent with Brook Group. And that is, the plaintiff must establish that there is a possibility of recouping. And once it establishes that, you have to prove barriers to entry.
You have to prove what? I didn't hear you.
Barriers to entry.
Barriers to entry.
And you have to prove the possibility of monopoly power. It's a market screen so that only a few predatory pricing claims will still get past summary judgment. I mean, we certainly aren't advocating throwing open the doors to every business owner who has a complaint that the guy across the street has low prices. Only in those industries where destruction of the competitor will lead to significant market power and barriers to entry are high so that new entrants can't come into the market will a plaintiff even survive summary judgment. That is the Brook Group test without the second clause of the recoupment requirement, which is the clause that makes it impossible to prove a predatory pricing claim.
Give me the exact wording of the second clause of the recoupment requirement. Now, you're not talking about the second element of recoupment, but you're talking about the language that follows the two elements that says, in order to demonstrate recoupment, you need, and what is the exact language that you take exception to?
Sure. And this is on page 2 of the reply brief. The plaintiff must demonstrate that there is a likelihood, one, that the predatory scheme alleged would cause a rise in prices above a competitive level, two, that would be sufficient to compensate for the amounts expended on the predation, including the time value of the money invested in it. This is the clause that the commentators in the federal courts have relied on to extinguish predatory pricing as a claim in the federal courts.
I'm sorry for being obtuse. Sometimes, like your opposing counsel uses this language, the plaintiff must demonstrate, and uses it as one clause. You, in your brief, break it up one, two clauses. Is it the language that would be sufficient to compensate for the amounts expended on the predation, including the time value? Is that what you're objecting to?
That's correct,
and
Justice.
Just those words?
That is correct, Justice. Now, the reason that we do object to that second clause of Brook Group, and I want to remind the Court that that was dicta, even in Brook Group, so there's no suggestion that this Court should come out and say, we totally disagree with that Supreme Court decision, because it was dicta. But the reason that we believe it's objectionable is because it does extinguish predatory pricing. And there's no question that predatory pricing occurs. Patrick Bolton, one of the leading antitrust commentators, says that empirical studies have shown that it can be a rational business strategy for a firm to engage in predatory pricing. Judge Posner has said that he has seen, it has been pointed out, recent scholarship has shown a non-trivial number of cases of predatory pricing. And even Wisconsin's legislature in 100.30, which is the Unfair Sales Act, which is a predatory pricing statute for retailers and wholesalers, clearly believes that it happens and that it's disfavored. The question that we pose to the court is, are we so confident that predatory pricing does not exist that we're comfortable adopting Brook Group lock, stock, and barrel and essentially saying no more predatory pricing? The trial court in this matter weighed expert testimony. We hired Professor Gollop, who is the Director of Graduate Studies at Boston College. He is a frequent consultant to the Department of Justice on antitrust matters, and he reviewed the materials, he reviewed the newspaper industry in this market, and he concluded that the journal's Sunday Daily giveaway constituted below-cost pricing and that the journal had the possibility of recouping its losses. The journal hired Kenneth Baseman. He reviewed the materials and said, this isn't predatory pricing. What the judge then did is to weigh the expert testimony and conclude that the journal's experts' conclusions were, quote, understandable. He then rejected Professor Gollop's conclusions. We believe that the Wisconsin law on the evaluation of expert testimony is clear. In the Court of Appeals certification in this matter, quoted the Green case and the Peters case to explain what that law is. Quote, once the relevancy of the evidence is established and the witness is qualified as an expert, the reliability of the evidence is a weight and credibility issue for the fact finder, and any reliability challenges must be made through cross-examination or by other means of impeachment. And importantly, the Court of Appeals certification went on to say, whereas here, the parties do not dispute the expert's qualifications or the relevancy of the testimony, Wisconsin law appears to favor leaving the reliability issues to the jury. We believe that's exactly what Wisconsin law favors and, in fact, what Wisconsin law requires. The journal is certainly free to cross-examine Professor Gollop about how he reached his conclusions. The jury should be able to witness that cross-examination and decide whether or not they believe expert Baseman or expert Gollop reach the right conclusions. The second.
Although amicus may take a different view, I understand your opposing party to say that there's no need to address the Daubert issue, that it's an advisory opinion to do so, and essentially they take the position that whether it's Daubert or Wallstead, you lose, so you don't have to address the issue. Do you believe that it's necessary to address the Daubert issue as I referred to it here today?
I certainly do not believe it's necessary or probably even appropriate to address whether or not Daubert should be adopted as the new standard for evaluating expert testimony in Wisconsin. That issue was never briefed down below. But what happened down below is we operated under the assumption that Wisconsin law, Wallstead, Peters, the Green case, applied in terms of evaluating our expert testimony. What the trial judge did, however, is to look at our methodology, say that he didn't agree with our methodology, but that he found the journal's methodology understandable, and he chose to accept the journal's methodology. So in a sense, the trial court was doing what federal judges are asked to do under Daubert. So only to that extent is it necessary to even think about Daubert. I mean, if Wisconsin law applies here, which we think it does, Daubert is not an issue. The second thing that the trial court did was to invent a new causation standard that we've never before seen in Wisconsin. Essentially, the trial court required the Freeman to quantify precisely every conceivable force that could have contributed to the Freeman's injury. That's not the law. In Wisconsin, it's a substantial factor test. That is, if the journal's conduct was a substantial factor in causing harm to the Freeman, then recovery is appropriate. And it doesn't have to be the cause. It has to be only a cause. In our jury instruction, the standard jury instruction in Wisconsin that we use for contract tort cases, any sort of case that involves cause, is that it must be a cause. Now, the Freeman produced significant record testimony about how this caused the Freeman injury. How did the daily conversion program, the newspaper giveaway, injure the Freeman? In other words, how did it cause the Freeman to lose subscribers? The first of those bits of evidence was that it was there was an actual effect that was very clear. In 1996, 1997, 1999, and 2000, the journal engaged in the giveaway plan in Waukesha. Each of those 4 years, the journal's subscription numbers in Waukesha went up, and the Freeman's numbers went down. In 1998, which was the only year that the journal didn't offer the free newspapers, the Freeman's subscription levels went up, and the journal's went down. And there's a clear correlation there, and it makes sense from a common sense standpoint. If you have two firms in a market who are trying to sell the same product, and one of those firms starts giving it away for free, it's not surprising that the other firm would suffer a loss, that they wouldn't be able to sell as many products.
Mr. Berryman, aren't there other explanations for the drop in circulation other than predatory pricing? As an example, afternoon papers around the country have seen a drop in circulation. I think the two Milwaukee papers combined several years ago because there was just that concern on behalf of the Milwaukee Journal. So how do you get around the fact that there is a ready explanation other than predatory pricing for the drop in circulation?
That is an excellent question, and I believe that the journal will try to point that out to the jury. That is, it wasn't predatory pricing. It wasn't the fact that we were giving away free newspapers. It was that this is an afternoon newspaper in a morning newspaper world. There was bad management at the Freeman. There was a change of ownership in 1997 at the Freeman. These are all potential causes that the journal should be free to stand up in court in front of a jury and say, this is what really caused the problem. But again,
I was just going to say, the judge in this case look at all of these things in terms of deciding whether or not to grant summary judgment and apparently came to the conclusion there were no genuine issues of material fact?
What the judge did is he pointed out in a small paragraph that the Freeman had failed to account for bad management and for new ownership. In other words, he was putting the burden on the plaintiff to come forward and say, it wasn't bad management and it wasn't new ownership. And that certainly is not the law in the state of Wisconsin. This is very similar to the disaggregation concept that the judge applied when it comes to looking at damages.
Was there an affidavit, for instance, countering the affidavit presented by the Journal Sentinel or the Journal Communications saying, no, that's not correct, that these things had nothing to do with the bottom line here, the drop in circulation, or had little to do with?
Certainly there was all kinds of record evidence that the real cause of this drop in circulation numbers was that the journal was giving away its newspapers for free. So the Conley did not come back and try to assign 9% of the damages to bad management and so on and so forth. But again, the court held as a matter of law that in spite of all these potential causes, the Sunday Daily conversion program simply did not cause harm to the Freeman. Wills v. Regan is a case that you often see cited for the causation issue, and it says, in cases where reasonable men might differ, which will include all but a few of the cases in which the causation issue, is in dispute at all, the question is one for the jury. And the third thing that the trial court did is to apply federal disaggregation concepts to the damages claims in this case. Some federal courts have adopted disaggregation in some antitrust contexts. Some have not. Some have rejected it. There has never been a Wisconsin court that has adopted disaggregation in any context.
What is the majority rule?
The majority rule, I can't say, Justice, that I've read all the cases, and I frankly wouldn't be comfortable offering you an opinion one way or the other. What I can say is
there a majority rule in this context, predatory pricing?
That I don't know. I do know that we've seen it applied in some cases. For instance, the MCI case, which is the case that the journal relied on and that the judge relied on. That's the only case that he cited in his opinion. But we also pointed out in our brief that there are courts that have rejected it, including, I believe, it's the Third Circuit. So it's clear that the federal courts are unsettled with the disaggregation concept. What's very clear also is that Wisconsin has never adopted it. It's
right,
brand
but
new
it is
here.
It is the law, settled law in Wisconsin, that in the antitrust context we follow the federal lead, and so the circuit court was in a position of having to either adopt disaggregation or not, and apparently he did, and said because you didn't, you're out of court.
That is correct, and we believe that his adoption of the disaggregation concept flies directly in the face of Wisconsin law on damages.
Well, Wisconsin doesn't have law, damages law, in the context of predatory pricing.
That's correct.
So there's nothing for it to be contrary to.
I understand. And this goes back to Justice Crook's question, which is sort of the procedural law versus the substantive law distinction. Wisconsin courts are very comfortable applying Wisconsin concepts of the evaluation of expert testimony, causation, and damages. And we believe that that should have held true in this case as well. And there's no special reason that this business tort should be treated differently than any other. But even if we did apply disaggregation to our claims, let me explain what it requires. It requires the plaintiff to separate out damages attributable to each type of allegedly anti-competitive conduct. So that if you're a plaintiff, and let's take this case for an example, and you allege two things. One, that the journal has advertising contracts that are exclusionary. That's one form of anti-competitive conduct. On the other hand, you allege that the Sunday Daily newspaper giveaway constitutes predatory pricing. What disaggregation requires is that you assign a certain damages figure to each of those two types of anti-competitive conduct. And that's exactly what our expert, Dagan, did. He made it very clear in his report, and I don't have his quote right here, but it said something like, I am assigning one amount of damages to the first allegation of anti-competitive conduct, the advertising contracts, and I am assigning a totally different number for damages to the Sunday Daily newspaper giveaway. He did exactly what disaggregation requires. Even in the MCI case, which is what the judge relied upon, the plaintiff had originally brought 22 separate antitrust causes of action to the court. Seven of those were dismissed on summary judgment. That left 15. The jury then came back after a trial and said, we believe that nine of those anti-competitive conduct allegations survives. So all of a sudden, we're down from 22 to 9. The problem in MCI was that the expert had formed his opinions and written his opinions and said, I'm basing this on 22 causes of action. Well, there was no way to figure out which anti-competitive activities that the jury found the defendant liable for accounted for which assignment of damages. If this were any other type of case in Wisconsin, any other business tort case, any other case under 133, we would have survived summary judgment easily on this record. There should be no new rules. And if you apply Wisconsin law on this record, there are clearly genuine issues of material fact for the jury.
And what are they?
The first one would be whether or not the journal engaged in below-cost pricing. Our expert said that they did. He looked at the documents. He found that the journal was spending or having costs of 35 cents per daily newspaper in Waukesha County. He found that the journal was receiving zero in return. They were charging zero. They were giving it away for free. And that's undisputed in the record. He concluded, after reviewing this industry, that that's below cost pricing. It's a very common sense. It makes sense. He also included that the journal would have the opportunity to recoup any losses that it suffers while it's engaging in below cost pricing once the Freeman is driven out of business. And there are two reasons that they could recoup. The first one is the journal would control the market. It would have a 100% market share. That is undisputed in the record as well. Mr. Spohr, the president of the journal, testified at deposition that he had once told the Conley publisher we will dominate the market. Well, he would be right. They would. They'd have 100%. The second reason that recoupment was possible here is because there are barriers to entry that are significantly high in the daily newspaper business. The court in Donnery, which examined this issue at great length, concluded that this is universally recognized and concluded that any argument to the contrary would be specious. In fact, the court said, don't even try to show that there's a different relevant market here because it's daily newspapers. Everybody who's looked at it has come to the same conclusion. So Judge Golub offered the testimony that both of the elements of predatory pricing, that is below-cost pricing with the opportunity to recoup after the competitor is gone, were present here.
What is the appropriate measure of cost for purposes of that first part of the Brook Group test?
That's a question that the commentators and the antitrust experts have been debating since the beginning of time. And I can't give you any better answer.
Not that long.
It's probably true. Since there were two businesses. A lot of commentators think that incremental cost, in other words, the amount of cost that it takes to produce another unit of output, is the best measure of cost. That's what our expert said, was that it's incremental or marginal cost. They mean the same thing.
What about in the newspaper business?
His conclusion, obviously, was that in the newspaper business, that's the best way to look at things.
Does that take into account advertising revenue?
It does not. And our expert decided that advertising revenue should not be taken into account. And there are a whole lot of reasons. I'm sorry, my red light is on.
You should finish an answer to the question, please.
Thank you, Justice. The first response to the question is, that's a good question that the journal should ask our expert on at trial, which is, well, why didn't your theory account for advertising? That's the way we do it in Wisconsin, vigorous cross-examination. The second answer is, and this is what Professor Golub's answer would be at trial, well, the journal didn't count advertising. There are documents in the record, at record number 27, Exhibit G, which is my affidavit attaching some journal documents, that show that in the journal's own analysis, when they were trying to figure out whether or not the Sunday Daily Conversion Program and another discount program were profitable, they accounted things like paper costs, delivery costs as costs, but when it came down to revenue, they didn't count advertising. It's right in the document, and the net revenue of the program is a negative $1.3 million. So at trial, Professor Golub will say, I didn't count costs because the journal didn't. I didn't count advertising because the journal didn't count advertising. And the fact that the journal's expert came along later on and said, well, we think you should count advertising, conflicts with simultaneous documents that the journal had in its possession. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney John R. Dawson of Foley and Lardner arguing for the Journal Communications. Mr. Dawson.
Thank you. May it please this Court. My name is John Dawson. I'm pleased to appear on behalf of Journal Communications and Journal Sentinel, Inc. In this proceeding, I'm joined by my partner, Paul Bargren. I don't know quite where to begin because the case is not nearly as complicated as counsel makes it appear. Let me respond, if I might, to the very first last question, Justice Sykes, that you asked. Connolly's lawyer says that we should ask Professor Golub, what about advertising? Well, we did, and it's in our brief. And he said, I didn't consider it because, he said, I don't think you make that much as you've lost. Therefore, no reason to. Of course, as the record shows, and as we pointed out in our papers, the whole reason for the project, for this marketing tool, is to make money, and it does. For every subscriber that is gained, the newspaper makes $200 in advertising revenue. I came here today prepared to discuss at some length the correlation between advertising revenue circulation, I don't think I need to burden the court with that. It's clear in our brief. It is undisputed. It is admitted by Connolly's people. You get newspapers out to sell advertising. That's the source of revenue. It is on the record, undisputed, that on average between 20% and 25% of a newspaper's revenues comes to circulation. The horse, the driver, is advertising. So when the circulation department, referring to the exhibit Mr. Berryman just referred you to, says this conversion program costs us circulation money, yes. That's absolutely a given and anticipated going in. It makes advertising money, and the newspaper makes money. And predatory pricing is not a difficult concept. You asked what measure of revenue should we use. The question is the actor, here the defendant, losing money? The answer is unequivocally, indisputably, on this record, no. It makes money. That's why it does it.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
In Wisconsin, generally, on expert testimony, and I remember the seminars of Irving Younger, who he would on expert testimony, and he would say, and we would discuss, because his was federal, but you could say, doctor or scientist, do you have an opinion? What is that opinion? Opinion to the requisite standard. And then he would say, Irving Younger would say, sit down. And in Wisconsin, of course, as other jurisdictions, we have not only 90702 regarding expert testimony, but a subsequent statute that says the underpinnings of the expert opinion, the basis of the expert opinion, need not be given. They can be brought out in cross-exam. So here we have a case where the expert has testified that he believes there's predatory pricing, that A, he believes there's below cost pricing, and B, possibility of recoupment. Why isn't that sufficient? And then, consistent with sometimes Irving Younger's admonition, why can't you just sit down and allow for cross under 90705, disclosure of facts or data underlying expert opinion?
Justice Bradley, the reason we expressed ourselves in our briefs in this way is precisely for the reason I'm about to say here. That is not what the judge below did. He did not, contrary to argument, consider whether or not he should give credence to or find reliable these experts' testimony. He accepted the testimony. There was no challenge to it in terms of its of the credibility of the witness or the individual's ability to express an expert testimony. What Judge Hassan concluded is, taking all of the testimony, it simply doesn't cover, doesn't address. Not that I disagree with it, as Connolly continues to argue. He didn't say that. He never said I disagree with Mr. Gollop or disagree with Mr. Deegan. He never mentioned once the journal's experts. It wasn't weighing experts. He said, I've looked at their testimony, and they don't consider these issues. And as a matter of law, he has to consider on the cost issue the revenue received from the project.
Well, let me.
And he didn't. And on the question of recoupment, Mr. Gollop never said they would recoup. We have no idea how much has to be recouped. No idea at all. What Professor Gollop said was, this is a market with a high barrier to entry. Conceded.
The market with what? I didn't
a high, high barriers to entry, Justice Wilcox. It is hard to start up a daily newspaper. It's a heavily capital-intensive investment.
Counsel, at Appendix 147, which is part of the report, the uh, I'm referring, counsel, to that last paragraph on 147.
Yes, it was highlighted for me to read it to you, Justice Breyer.
Oh, well, it's highlighted for me to read it to you, too.
All right.
One of you should read it. Why don't you go first?
Well, two necessary conditions. I'm quoting now from Professor Gallup. Quote, Mr. Bram, I'm reading in there. Are you with me?
Furthermore, right before that, furthermore, it's my opinion that the journal's action constitute predatory pricing. Then,
two necessary conditions defining predatory pricing seem to be satisfied. One, the journal's avoided cost of producing and delivering four fewer Sunday issues to converted subscribers is below the journal's incremental cost incurred to produce and deliver the daily paper to these addressees.
Let's just stay with that finding.
Okay.
That's the first element. Now, as I understand the trial judge's opinion, he has said, oh, I don't agree with that, because that opinion, Dr. Gallup, does not consider the cost of advertising. Well, that was the conclusion of the trial court. Because he didn't consider the cost of advertising and arriving at his opinion that it is below cost pricing, that it cannot, the plaintiff cannot prevail on that issue at summary judgment.
I think that is exactly what he decided, Justice Bradley. And I believe that question is one of law. Do you consider the money that the defendant is getting by cause of the program in deciding whether it's losing money or not, or do you not? It's a simplistic question, and it admits of a simplistic answer. Well, of course you do. And Professor Gallup, when he was asked if he considered, he didn't say no, it is necessary. Connolly's briefs repeatedly say Professor Gallup opined that it was unnecessary and you should not consider advertising revenue. That misstates the record, Justice Bradley. What he said was, I didn't consider it because I didn't think you made enough money in advertising to offset the cost. That's in our brief, quoted from his deposition. Well, the newspaper does make more money than Professor Gallup decided it cost.
Well,
that's why they do the program. Excuse me.
You said at page 6 of your brief in the excerpted question-answer, in answer, in part, he says, I really don't think it was necessary to say that one additional subscription would generate $66 in advertising revenue. I just can't believe one subscription generates $66 in advertising revenue. That's why he explained that he did not add it to the equation, as I understand it.
I agree with your understanding, and that is precisely my point, Justice Bradley. He didn't consider it because he didn't think the revenue would be sufficient to offset the $66 that he attributes to the per subscriber. In fact, it's three times that. It's over $200.
Does that go to the credibility or believability of his opinion, or does it constitute a failure of proof?
Well, I will answer that two ways, Justice Sykes. Were he on the same from a jury, his credibility would be very much challenged on that issue. But we don't get to that point. This is a question of law. You asked earlier, what revenue do we consider? You consider all the revenue that the defendant gets because of the challenged conduct. I mean, that is what a predatory pricing case is about. And here, the whole purpose of the program is to generate advertising revenue. That's why more than half, this is a record, more than half of the major newspapers in the country do this program at any one time. They're doing it regularly. The Journal Sentinel has done it at least since 1988, all over the areas that it serves. Now, you get a tunnel vision view of the world in litigation, I know. But the notion that this happens just in Waukesha County and just because the Waukesha Freeman is simply refuted by the undisputed fact of record that this conversion program is done by the Journal Sentinel all over the counties it serves, including areas in which Connolly argues the paper has a monopoly. It does it in Ozaukee County, Milwaukee County, Washington County, all the areas that it serves. Regularly, they rotate. 50,000 calls a year doing this.
Is it proper then to take advertising revenue into consideration when considering the recoupment part of the Brooks Group test?
Well,
do you know what I'm driving at? For example,
In this sense, because recoupment becomes a red herring in this case, the court does not need to address the Brook Group recoupment issue that I do want to respond to, if I may, in a minute. But there's no loss to recoup. More importantly, plaintiff's case and plaintiff in responding to summary judgment is supposed to show a basis for going forward. That is, its burden under Wisconsin law did not show what was to be recouped. And so, certainly didn't show how it could possibly be recouped.
So you don't get to the issue of recoupment unless you can clear the hurdle of below cost.
Yes, ma'am. I think Brook makes it quite clear. There are two elements, just as was let off by Mr. Berryman. Predatory pricing, below cost pricing, defendants losing money, and by virtue of that, is going to reduce competition to the extent that it can make it up later. And it is the, and that's what Brook Group says. The dicta of which plaintiff talks about goes to the specificity with which the recoupment number must be proven. That isn't even in this case. No one disputes the continuing vitality of Brook Group's two elements: predatory pricing, below cost, you're losing money, and high probability of recoupment. Because it is the latter point that the whole construct out of the antitrust laws on this issue is designed to prevent. It is only if the General Sentinel is able to raise prices to an extent that it can make more money from consumers than it has lost in a program that consumers are injured.
Right. And on that score, do we take into consideration the paper's ability to jack up advertising prices in evaluating the recoupment issue? Let's say you lose on the below cost.
I think that's fair, yes. If it puts itself in a position where it can recoup, regardless of how, but there's no evidence of that, it's not my burden, nor is it yours, ma'am, to try to find a way plaintiff might have proven this case. It can't, because there's no loss to begin with. To prevail here,
Mr. Berryman argued for a modified approach, as I understood it, in regard to the recoupment step or the recoupment factor. Do you have any comment about his modified approach that he referred to from his reply brief?
I do, Justice Crooks, and I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. I'm hesitating only because I'm not sure quite what proposal I'm to respond to. It's changed, and it changed. Now we're in the third iteration of it. The third iteration of a proposal of a proposed ruling of law from this court, contrary to the United States Supreme Court ruling of Brook Group and every court that has considered the issue since 1993, state and federal. Plaintiff here wants you to adopt a different rule, but every time it tells you what the rule is, it changes. I think I heard Mr. Berryman say, I put it in quotation, that now the recoupment must be a possibility of recouping. I guess my reaction to that would be that's impossibly vague. What does that mean? That's not what Brook Group says.
Well,
Why do
you finish?
Well, that's not what Brook Group says, and the question is why would that be a better test? Connolly doesn't explain that. They just don't like the Brook Group test. And it's curious that Connolly would ask this court not to follow Brook Group, contrary to almost 100 years of precedent of this court, of not following but giving great, great deference to the federal courts in this area with which we don't have a lot of experience in Wisconsin. And to do so with respect to a case that Connolly itself brought suit under, urged upon the trial court, urged be followed in the appellate court, saying both of these principles make good sense, they're logical. And then when they realized after reading the response in the appellate court level, said, oh, wait a minute, Brook Group isn't any good. Change it. Don't follow it. There's nothing wrong with a Brook Group test. Two elements. Did the defendant lose money? And is there a high probability that it will recoup that loss so the consumers end up paying more than they otherwise would be? And there's just no evidence in the record on either point, and that's all Judge Hassan said, held. He didn't say, I disagree with this expression by the expert. He just said he didn't cover the point. And it's plaintiff's burden to do so.
Counsel, in looking at this predatory price clause of action, I was reminded of a case that we decided last year, Village Food and Liquor Mart. That case dealt with predatory pricing in the context of 100.30, selling gasoline below the minimum markup. And the discussion in that case traced the common law tort of unfair competition and focused on the common law tort of unfair competition as it applied to unfair trade practice involving price cutting in a controlled market. Several times in preparation for this case, I was wondering why this wasn't brought as a common law tort cause of action for predatory pricing, because it would be easier for me to read. But
I suspect,
setting that aside.
I suspect plaintiff's lawyers state, well, I will take that into account next time they plead one of these cases.
That's right. Make it easier to read. But
it may.
This opinion then discusses the existence of this common law tort. It's talks of Blackstone, talks of 1848, and indeed this is an example itself of predatory pricing. It seems to me that part of the Brook rationale is to deny the possibility of, if not the rationale, the effect of Brook is to deny the possibility of bringing a predatory price claim. I'm not sure this is currently accurate, but in the article that's been referred to by Bolton, it is asserted that since 1993, Brook was decided, that no plaintiff has got past summary judgment on predatory pricing. That article is written in 2000. I don't know if that's still accurate today. But it sure seems to me, if that is accurate, that under the Brook test, it's nigh on impossible to meet it and to maintain a cause of action. How do you respond to, I guess, that double-barreled question? Number one, is it nigh on impossible to bring a predatory pricing claim? And two, is the rationale for making it nigh on impossible, that is, no rational plaintiff business person would do it, isn't that assertion belied by our own case history and recent case discussion in Village Foods?
And I only have 10 minutes left to answer that question.
But let me repeat it.
No, first of all, first of all, a predatory pricing case cannot be brought in this case, which I trust commands the court's at least primary attention, because it doesn't exist. Of course, Conley has a hard time satisfying the elements and did not satisfy any of them below because the facts don't support the claim. There's nothing in Brook Group that would prevent, I speak now hypothetically because it's contrary to what the record shows and what I know the fact to be, to show that, one, the newspaper did in fact lose money. And what if it didn't increase advertising? What if it just gave papers away, as they say? Actually, what they did was sell them at a 50% discount. They gave nothing away. But let's say they did lose money. I mean, businesses do lose money in response to various programs they engage in. The first element can be satisfied. The second element is, how much do they lose, and how are they going to get it back? Now, that's not a insurmountable challenge. And as the Supreme Court said in Brook Group, this is not meant to be unnecessarily difficult. It reflects the market reality, because unless you can recoup the money that you've lost, consumers are going to benefit. That's why it should be a hard claim to assert, because consumers are the beneficiaries unless they are made ultimately to pay more than they otherwise would have. In this case, and I know my opposing counsel quite well, were the facts there, the record would be there. An expert would say they lost $55, and in this instance, in these different players in the country, and the same thing has happened, price have increased by 0.5%, and over 1 year they will recover $58. That's recoupment. I mean, it isn't as hard as these prolix briefs sometimes make it appear.
Should the fact that in this context we're talking about the achievement of a complete monopoly have any effect on the equation?
It should not, because market structure alone cannot provide a basis for a conclusion of recoupment if the facts are to the contrary. The Seventh Circuit in the MCI case, Brook Group, and Supreme Court itself, and this is not a Daubert decision. In fact, this is Brook Group, you may realize, is pre-Daubert, said if the expert's opinion is simply contrary to facts of record, you can't rely upon it. Now, Judge Hansen didn't do that. He just never commented upon, do I accept this or not accept this. But the fact is, that the Journal Sentinel charges the same circulation rates, provides the same discounted programs, this Sunday conversion, everywhere, not just where the Freeman is. So I think, Justice Sykes, the fact that a monopoly is possible, or in Connolly's, as Connolly would say, actually in existence in counties other than Waukesha, is a factor, but it's a factor. It's not dispositive. As a matter of law, it's not dispositive.
Could you give an example of what the Journal Sentinel would have had to do in order to engage in predatory pricing? I mean, just hypothetically, what might they have done that would have given a cause of action the Freeman?
It's the kind of question lawyers hate to hear, Justice Cross, right?
Pardon me?
They could have misjudged. They could have decided that it was in their interest, because of the impact upon advertising revenue, to do even more than they were doing. I was about to say to get papers out there, but in fact, as you know from the record, a newspaper can't discount more than 50% off its published price, or it can't count it as a circulated newspaper. If I give you my newspaper, you don't add to my circulation base. You have to pay at least half of the face value. That's why these conversion programs were always structured so that the discount was never more than 50%, so they could count circulation. But hypothetically, forget that impediment. Let's say the newspaper made a mistake and just gave hundreds of thousands of newspapers away for a year, hoping that it would be able, once there were 300,000 new readers, it could make up whatever those newspapers cost in increased or additional advertising revenue. And let's say they misjudged. I'm sorry, let's say they were right, and they made even more. And then they could really start charging the readers and the advertisers. That's not a very good example, because in this context, I have trouble thinking one, frankly. But conceptually, it is certainly possible. And the only learning that I draw from the difficulty plaintiffs have had in this area of surviving summary judgment is it is a difficult claim to assert, and it's supposed to be. That's what the court said they meant to be doing. This is not an oversight by the Supreme Court. Nor, of course, will it be here. I'm going to speak very briefly to the issue of causation to which counsel referred. You may search this record, and I no doubt have, as diligently as I have. You will not find any expert, either Mr. Gollop or Mr. Deegan, or any representative of Connolly Publishing saying the Journal Sentinel Sunday Daily Conversion Program caused our circulation to decline. nowhere appears. So when Judge Hassan said, there is just no fact of record upon which I can find a basis for attributing all of the circulation that the Freeman complains of, all the circulation loss, upon this conversion program, there are just no facts there. Once again, he wasn't disagreeing with.
Well, counsel, wasn't, just so I didn't misunderstand this, when your opposing counsel indicated there were 2 years and then there was a break where there, where the conversion program wasn't done, that the subscriptions went up, and then when they reestablished it, it went down. So, but I mean, that's a matter of record, isn't it? I mean,
that's a matter of record, and that's a fact.
You didn't need somebody to testify to that. That was a given.
No.
But and Justice Crooks asked, well, there could have been many other reasons, but there, but the point is that at least those 5 years, I take it, were
Actually,
factual.
Justice Wilcox, it was 2 years.
Well, there were 5 years given. That's correct. Only 1 year out of the five, as I understand it, that I heard from opposing counsel, when the Freeman gained subscribers.
1998. That's correct. The damages is this ties in, if I may, with what I like to say briefly on causation. The claim asserted is that every single subscriber that the Freeman lost in 1996 through the year 2000, every single one of them quit the Freeman, and then for years thereafter, if they quit in 96, they didn't renew for 4 more years, every single one, because of this program. And justices, no person ever said that, and it's nonsensical on its face, but no one said that. Their damages expert, Mr. Deegan, simply said, here's the total number. I multiply that by profit per paper. This is the damage. And we don't need to get bogged down by discussing disaggregation, which really is causal connection. That's all it means, and issues of like kind. It is plaintiff's burden to prove a causal connection between the conduct complained of and the injury complained of. And there is none here. That's the significance of all the other factors going on at the same time, among others. You might very well, were you a juror, say, well, there must be some connection between the program in 96 and the decline in circulation. Maybe so. Don't know. But how about what the Freeman itself admits was bad management at that time under the ownership of Thompson Newspapers? Maybe the decline in 1997 is attributable in some respect to program. Who knows? How about the fact that upon acquiring the paper in May 1997, Connolly increased the prices and by their own testimony caused circulation to decline? The significance of all these other factors, Sunday newspaper, afternoon newspaper, bad management, increasing prices, decreasing discounts, is that there are lots of reasons why the Freeman was having trouble. And it violates Wisconsin law, not federal law, the simple law of first-year contract law, cause and effect, first-year tort law, cause and effect, to simply say, we lost money these years, and that's all your fault. And that's exactly what they said, and that's all they said. And when Judge Hassan said, there's simply nothing in the record to tie the two together, he wasn't diminishing the testimony of Mr. Deegan. Mr. Deegan did some arithmetic, and it's correct arithmetic. There's just nobody says that the numbers are attributable to what the complaint complains of here. And that is crystal clear, Wisconsin law. We are not asking the court to deviate from its own damages analysis, causation analysis. It's just really basic issues.
Isn't that the same concept of disaggregation?
Disaggregation, I believe it is, Chief Justice. The disaggregation arises principally when, as Mr. Berryman said, there are multiple unlawful acts complained of. And in case the court or the jury throws out one or more of them, it is the burden of the plaintiff to show how much of what remains has caused the damage complained of.
Well, here, as I understand it, you're saying there are the allegation is multiple unlawful acts, but that there are business reasons for the harm here, that is, the damages to the company.
I'm saying when there are multiple causes, And it's not causes that Doss and the lawyers stand before this Court and says are causes. It's causes which the Freeman's own people admit are the causes.
So it's both lawful and unlawful.
All of it lawful. Mm-hmm. Lawful causes. Disaggregation applies when it arises in cases discussing multiple unlawful causes when some are eliminated. The same concept applies when there are multiple causes, some lawful, some unlawful. You can't simply say, you did this one unlawful thing, and therefore we're damaged by everything that happened, it's your fault, which is what Connolly says here. Chief, my red light is on.
I know. Counsel, I have one more question I'm going to ask of Mr. Berryman, too. How would you write this opinion? Give me a fast outline.
I would say, in the first place, Judge Hassan was absolutely correct in finding there was no dispute of material fact with respect to whether or not there was predatory pricing in either or both of two respects. In the first place, there was no evidence, and certainly no dispute of material fact, as to the failure of Professor Gallup to take into account the revenue derived by the defendant from the conduct complained of, and that as a matter of law, that revenue must be considered and taken into account. And secondly, that if there was below-cost pricing, contrary to the conclusion just reached, plaintiff showed no possibility of recoupment. He showed the merest it was feasible. And that's not plaintiff's burden under the Brook Group test. And that is the touchstone of predatory pricing. Secondly, I would say that even if those two elements were established, there was no dispute of material fact upon the basis of which the plaintiff could have been allowed to go to a jury on the issue of causation or damages. All that the plaintiff did is say, we lost these many subscribers over this five-year period, including those who didn't renew. They multiplied that number by the profit per subscriber and have a number. And they do that in the context in which there were multiple causes by their own admission of their circulation decline. And that therefore, on all three issues, no below-cost pricing, no recoupment, and no showing of causation, there was no dispute of material fact justifying this matter proceeding, and Judge Hassan was right on all three points.
Thank you.
Yes, sorry. One question. If this case were brought as my unfair trade practice common law.
I forgot. I apologize. I forgot
no,
your question.
No, that's okay. I've resolved that. I've got another question. If it were brought as a common law tort, not as an antitrust claim, would you still be arguing disaggregation of damages?
Absolutely.
Is it your position that disaggregation of damages applies in all of Wisconsin damages jurisprudence or only with regard to antitrust jurisprudence?
Disaggregation is most often discussed. The word, you find the word most often in federal antitrust cases. But the point I made a minute ago I'd like to repeat. I don't think it expresses or embraces a concept different from proximate cause. Causation.
I agree with you that they're intermingled, but so your argument with regard to the concept of disaggregation of damages is your argument of what the law of damages is generally here in the state of Wisconsin.
And causation. Plaintiff cannot say there are these 15 things responsible for my injury. Jury, do your best. Figure it out. That's not permissible, and that's exactly what happened here, and that's what Judge Hassan held. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. Mr. Berryman, you have 5 minutes, and I hope you'll outline an opinion in your favor.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may, I'll respond quickly to Justice Bradley's last question. And there's a quote from a Wisconsin case on page 34 of our opening brief that says this: in all cases involving problems of causation and responsibility for harm, a good many factors may have united in producing the result. The plaintiff's total injury may have been the result of many factors, in addition to the defendant's tort or breach of contract? Must the defendant pay damages equivalent to the whole, to the total harm suffered? Generally, the answer is yes, even though there were contributing factors other than his own conduct. That's the state of the law in Wisconsin. The federal disaggregation concept, which some federal courts have adopted and others have rejected in the antitrust context, is not the law in the state of Wisconsin. And if I may,
are you suggesting by that quote that if I'm injured, auto accident, I'm injured, and I say in my complaint I'm injured, negligence, causation, damages, that the opposing counsel can't, through discovery, say, oh, you had a pre-existing condition, and the reason you can't walk now is you lost 1.5 legs before? I mean, is it your position that regardless of other factors, as long as you can prove a factor, you get total damages?
I used to be a product liability lawyer in my former life, and we always said that you take the plaintiff as you find him. And I think that that is the law in Wisconsin, though I can't say that I've kept up on it because I no longer do that. What's clear in this case, though, is that our expert, Carl Dagan, looked at the two types of anti-competitive conduct that are alleged. He said this type caused one injury and this type caused another. He assigned separate values to each one. Now we're sitting here with one, that's predatory pricing, and he assigned specific numbers to that particular anti-competitive conduct.
What is there in the record to link the alleged predatory pricing to the drop in circulation, apart from that chart that shows that there was a drop during the relevant years?
Right.
Is there anything else besides that?
Yeah, a few things that I've tried to make clear earlier. One of those is what Justice Wilcox goes back to, which is over the course of 5 years, every year they offered it, the Freeman circulations fell. The 1 year they didn't, the Freeman circulation rose.
Right. Apart from that, is there anything in the record to link?
Well, one interesting point is there is all kinds of evidence in the record that the journal, with its Sunday daily conversion program, fully intended to convert Freeman subscribers to journal subscribers.
Well, that intent doesn't convert to proof of causation.
It doesn't necessarily. But if we assume that the journal did a reasonably good job of doing what it is they were trying to do, then it's fair to assume that readers left the journal, left the Freeman and went to the journal.
That sounds pretty speculative to me. Is that all there is?
No. One more.
Okay.
The other evidence of cause is, I guess, what I would call a common sense cause, which is if I'm a Waukesha subscriber to the Freeman and I'm paying for that, and I get a telemarketing call that says, we're the journal, we want to give you the daily paper for free, it's pretty likely that I may take the free paper.
Okay. As I understand your argument, apart from the causation and damages, apart from the disaggregation issue, it's that this is a jury question. There are logical inferences to be drawn from the drop in circulation, which corresponded to the years that the conversion program was in place. And it sounds like that is your argument.
Absolutely.
There isn't anything beyond that.
There are a lot of potential causes, and we believe that the jury should be allowed to hear them.
Mr. Dawson said that the Journal Sentinel engaged in this daily Sunday conversion program in many other areas besides Waukesha County. What is your rebuttal to that?
It's clear that in 1996 and 1997, Waukesha County was the focus of this program. In fact, there's a document that's in the materials that's titled Waukesha Focus, and it explains how that in 1997 and beginning in January of 97, the journal would call every single 52-week Sunday-only subscriber. These are people who have already paid to get the Sunday newspaper. And they would offer them 49 weeks of free daily newspapers, every one of them. And if you go a few paragraphs down on that same document, it shows that they will call all 26-week Sunday-only subscribers. And they will offer to give those people 23 weeks of the Journal Sentinel for free, the daily newspaper. And this goes back to a point in the record that I wanted to correct, and that is that this was a free newspaper giveaway. That's not a term that we've come up with. They already had a contract in place with subscribers, and subscribers were offered 49 weeks of free newspapers. We asked Ms. Mueller, who's with the journal, what that meant. She said it means they didn't have to pay a single penny. So that's undisputed evidence on the record.
But, I mean, did they do that in Milwaukee County, too? Did they do it in Ozaukee County? Did they do it in Washington County?
The record evidence is not as clear as we would like it to be, but it is clear that in 96 and 97, there was a blanketing of Waukesha County and there wasn't elsewhere. In 98, they didn't offer the program in Waukesha County, and that's what we've referred to earlier. And in 99 and 2000, they were offering it in Waukesha County and out and in parts of the other four-county area.
Now, Chief, do you want an answer to your question?
It certainly would make a difference if there weren't any newspapers in any other community and they came in and they offered to raise their number of subscribers. But I believe the predatory pricing comes in when there is a legitimate business, whether it's newspapers or anything else, and then they come in and there's a freebie offered to that's the difference. It doesn't make any difference. I don't know whether they came up to Washira County. There's no daily newspaper there, and I don't think it would make much difference.
That's right. There is no anti
coming up that far, but I'm just saying that it only makes a difference where you have a competitor.
That's absolutely right. To Chief Justice Abrams' question, we believe that the opinion should start out by saying predatory pricing as a cause of action in the state of Wisconsin is not going to be extinguished because it happens. The commentators say it happens. Our own legislature in 100.30 says it happens. We have a statute that specifically talks about predatory pricing and applies it to retailers and wholesalers. We believe that the case should be remanded for trial. The court should write that summary judgment was not appropriate because there were disputed issues. There were disputed issues of expert testimony. Professor Gollop brought to the table the elements of a predatory pricing claim. There were disputed issues of causation, and there were disputed issues of damages. And in Wisconsin, these are issues for the jury. We also believe that the best way, which is consistent with Brook Group's holding, is to examine the market structure, which is what Brook Group tells us to do. That is, look at whether or not the market is concentrated, and look at whether or not there are significant barriers to entry. If the answer is no to either of those two questions, then dismiss the case. There's no predatory pricing. Because, for instance, if there are low barriers to entry and a competitor is driven out of business by low prices, someone else will come in and take his spot or her spot. So we believe that if the answer to either of those questions is no, the case should be dismissed. We are not advocating opening the courthouse doors to businesses who are unhappy that their competitors are pricing low. If the answer is yes to both of those cases, though, this becomes a business tort case that goes to the jury. The jury looks at what the low-pricing firm was up to. They may look at price-cost tests to determine whether or not the pricing was below cost. They may look at the intent of that actor, see if they were trying to get a monopoly. And if the answer to all those questions is yes, then the jury should render a verdict for the plaintiff. We believe that this approach prevents monopolies and ensures competition. It's consistent with the policy of Chapter 133, which is pointed out in 133.01. Thank you, Your Justices.
Thank you, Mr. Berryman. Thank you, Mr. Dawson, for your arguments. And it appears to me to be a complex case, but that you attempted to simplify for the court. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.